from the Rolling Stones to Emily Dickinson, who once wrote of fall, "The morns are meeker than they were. The nuts are getting brown. The berry's cheek is plumper. The rose is out of town." Well, writer Julie Zicafus is no stranger to a plump berry. She has this essay on waiting for hers.
"I have a friend who lives up in the mountains of North Carolina who loves to give me wonderful plants. Usually Connie gives me native prairie plants, and I plop them in the meadow, and it's no big deal. But this year she gave me raspberries, not just any raspberries, golden raspberries. Now, giving someone 5 raspberry plants is kind of like giving someone a pony. You don't just plop raspberries in a meadow. You have to dig them a bed with nice, rich soil, and that bed has to have edging all around it because raspberries root when the tips of their canes touch the ground. So you've got to make them a home where they'll be content to stay. I dug and dug and turned soil and threw the Virginia creeper out and made a nice, fluffy bed. Then I dug a trench around the bed for the edging, which still had to be bought. Then I collapsed from the heat and exertion and had to be put in my own fluffy bed. 2 days later, I pulled the raspberry plants out of their pots, smiling with satisfaction at the new white feeder roots they'd grown. I planted them in their new bed, piled fresh straw around them, and watered them down. Now all I have to do is wait a year for them to flower and fruit. The raspberries went right in beside the asparagus, which my husband and I planted in 1992. Wanting to let the plants get established, we didn't harvest any for the first 3 years. But oh, the meals we've had since. My father told me something that has stuck with me for 40 years. A neighbor was watching him as he planted dwarf fruit trees in our yard. 'How long will it take for him to bear fruit?' he asked. 'Oh, 5, maybe 6 years,' Dad replied. 'Oh, I wouldn't bother planting fruit trees. I wouldn't want to wait that long,' the neighbor said. Dad was quiet for a moment. 'You're already waiting. Might as well have some fruit to look forward to.' I look out from the kitchen window at the tidy little raspberry bed, new lime green leaves just peeking up over the straw mulch, and I'm baking a fine golden raspberry tart in my mind, pulling the chilled dough up around a double handful of fruit, sprinkling a little sugar over the top, popping it in the oven to bake for 40 minutes at 400 degrees. Already waiting."
Julie Zicafus lives and gardens in Whipple, Ohio. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The company that administers the SAT says it catches hundreds of people a year trying to impersonate test takers. Officials from the Educational Testing Service spoke at a New York State Senate hearing today, where lawmakers are investigating an alleged SAT cheating ring. Charles Lane of member station WSHU reports.
6 students allegedly hired a former student to take their SAT test for them. All 7 were arrested on criminal charges. The SAT administrator, Educational Testing Service, said last month that such cases are rare. But today, they revised that statement and said nationally about 750 would-be impersonators are caught at the door, and another 150 are caught after their SAT scores trigger an investigation that compares handwriting samples. ETS says they expect the cheating scandal to grow, with more indictments from Long Island and another state. But all this is the tip of the iceberg, according to educational officials who testified at today's hearing. Bernard Kaplan is the principal at Great Neck North High School, where the initial cheating investigations have been focused.
"They let the students take it anywhere they want. They make it easy to cheat, hard to get caught, and if they do get caught, there is historically minimal consequence."
Kaplan and others are suggesting that ETS beef up security by fingerprinting or photographing students, and that tests should be given at the student's own high school, presumably where impersonators would be recognized. But ETS President Kurt Landgraf says the cost of such reforms would be passed on to students, and that already their security is world class.
"If we suspect someone has been using an impersonator, we go after them with every means we have available."
Landgraf adds that current law prohibits ETS from notifying anyone except the student that cheating may have occurred. ETS is also promising to review security procedures. Lawmakers say they will consider making cheating on the SAT a crime. Right now, cheating is only referred to prosecutors if money changed hands. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
And now to matters of personal finance. Most people probably know this. Latinos are now the largest minority group in the U.S., but according to a recent report by a respected research group, they are among the least likely to invest in or keep money in retirement savings accounts, like 401ks. According to the Pew Hispanic Center, just 10% of the nation's 50.5 million Hispanics have individual retirement or KEO accounts. That's compared to 35% of non-Hispanic whites. And just 24% of Latinos have 401k or thrift accounts. That's compared to 45% of non-Hispanic whites. Here to tell us more about this is Jamie Levy Pessin. She's a freelance financial journalist who recently reported on this for the Wall Street Journal. Jamie, welcome back. Also joining us is one of our regular contributors on matters of personal finance and the economy, one of our money coaches, Luis Barajas. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Jamie, you reported on this. You cited in your piece two reasons, culture and wages. And first, I want to ask you to separate those two. First, on the culture question, you quote people who say that with Latinos, the focus is kind of investing in family, with the understanding that the family will take care of you when you retire. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. According to several of the researchers I spoke to, in the Latino culture, there's a very big emphasis on helping your family and friends, your immediate community. If your nephew needs money to pay for his daughter's wedding, you're much more likely to help him out. You're much more likely to take care of your parents when they're older than putting money away for yourself for retirement.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about how much of this is a preference and how much of this is circumstance. So, Jamie, what about the whole question of wages? That people who, you know, it's not exactly a secret that, you know, Latinos and African Americans are more likely to be in the lower wage end of the spectrum. And so if they are in the lower wage end of the spectrum, even if they have access to, you know, retirement accounts through their employers or have opened up their own individual retirement accounts, they're more likely to feel that they have to tap into those accounts. I mean, how much of a role does just the lower wages have to play in this?
I think that's definitely a factor. I mean, you can definitely talk about whether, you know, lower wage employees even have access to things like 401ks. But I think one of the surprising numbers that came out in the Ariel Hewitt study, which was a very big study of kind of retirement savings across different minority groups, showed that even at the highest salary level, salary of $120,000 or above, Hispanics had the least amount saved for retirement. It was at that salary level, Hispanics had $150,000 saved for retirement compared with $155,000 for African Americans, $161,000 for whites. So I thought that was a really number two, is that even though, yes, it's true that, you know, the farther down on the socioeconomic scale you may fall, you know, the less likely you are to even have access to a retirement account, that even as you get higher up that wage scale, you're still seeing a gap.
Let me just clarify this, that what Jamie's talking about is a study by the Ariel Education Initiative. That's the nonprofit arm of the Chicago money management firm Ariel Investments, in conjunction with Hewitt Associates. And they reported on all income levels, as Jamie just told us, and they said that even at the highest income level counted, which was a salary of $120,000 or above, Hispanics had the least amount saved. And Jamie just told you that, interesting, at the highest end was Asians at $223,000 saved. But Luis, I want to ask you, is this a matter of preference? Or is there still a socioeconomic component attached to this? How do you read that?
Well, it's really complex because at the same time, you have to understand that the Latino community is the least educated community. And so they lack education, thus they lack, you know, jobs where they're paying more money. Now, what happens is that if with most people, especially these days, we have what are called like the sandwich generation, where somebody who's making good money is taking care of their parents and taking care of their children. When you have Latinos that are doing financially well, there's usually one out of, let me, three or four kids that is doing well. And they're what I call the club sandwich generation, where you add another layer. They're also helping take care of their nieces and nephews sometimes. And there's just not a lot of money to go around. And so you're realizing that instead of spending money on, you know, their 401k, they're using it to help out family members. And remember, a lot of Hispanics send money away to the countries of origin to help out other family members there as well.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about new information that shows that Latinos are less likely to invest in retirement accounts when compared to other groups. I'm joined by Luis Barajas. He's one of our regular contributors on matters of personal finance and the economy. And Jamie Levy Pessin, a freelance journalist for The Wall Street Journal, who recently reported on this. Jamie, you also had some interesting findings about initiatives by some financial services companies who are not stupid, who see that there's an opportunity here to perhaps persuade more people to invest. What were some of the techniques that they used to get those numbers up?
Sure. I think that that's exactly right, Michelle, that, you know, these banks are looking at the census numbers and saying, whoa, this is a very fast growing population in the U.S., and that's a consumer base for us. You're seeing a lot of kind of initiative on the bank's parts to kind of reach out to employers with large Hispanic employee populations and kind of come up with creative ways to boost their investments in 401ks. So, for example, you have ING Group, who is not just translating documents into Spanish when, you know, you get the mailings about enrolling in your 401k. They're totally rewriting it to kind of address some of the cultural differences they see. For example, you know, there's not necessarily a baseline assumption that you should put away money for retirement. So they're rewriting materials to explain why it's important to do this before they go on to talk about here's how to do it.
But what about, Lewis, let me just ask you that this, given a lot of what people are seeing in the news about financial institutions who are seen as perhaps less than sound, there are a lot of headlines about kind of the global difficulties.
A lot of volatility in the market.
I mean, this is part of your business. Can you really look people in the face and say, this is really where you should put your money? You really do need to do this, and these are the instruments that you really need to put money into.
Yeah, and that's what you really need to do, is you need to actually show them that putting money into a retirement plan, especially a 401k, is really sacred money, that they need to do it, because otherwise they're not going to have any money for the future when they retire. You know, I don't need a crystal ball to let someone know what their future's like if they're not putting any money away for retirement. But you hit a nerve there, because what happens is you have to understand that most first-generation people, especially people coming from like Mexico, are coming from poor countries with corrupt governments, with corrupt financial institutions. Then they come here, and then they're watching the television and they're listening to everything that you just mentioned. The person's just not as confident anymore. They're thinking, it's just the same as in my country as it is here. Why should I put money that may not be there in the future? So it's a whole issue of trust and confidence.
Lewis, why does this matter?
Well, it matters because even though right now, you know, there's 50.5 million Hispanics living in the U.S., by the year 2050, one out of every three persons living in the U.S. will be Hispanic. And the last thing we want is for this large demographic to be a social burden on America. And it's really important to start doing something about it now.
Lewis Barajas is a personal finance expert and author. He's the author of The Latino Journey to Financial Greatness, among other books. He was kind enough to join us from Costa Mesa, California. Jamie Levy-Pesson is a freelance financial journalist for The Wall Street Journal. She was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Steve Jobs always believed that technology required the point of view of the liberal arts. It's a vision encapsulated in the products he introduced, from the Macintosh to the iPod, iPhone, and others that bore the prefix I. According to Fresh Air's linguist, Jeff Nunberg, that prefix stands in for a vision that is coming of age throughout the world of technology.
Steve Jobs did his last product launch last March for the iPad 2. At the close, he stood in front of a huge picture of a sign showing the intersection of streets called technology and liberal arts. It was an abiding ideal for Jobs, the same one that had drawn him to make his famous 1979 visit to the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, or Xerox Park for short. That was where a group of artistically minded researchers had developed the graphical user interface, or GUI, which Apple's developers were to incorporate into the Lisa and the Macintosh a few years later. The interfaces bundle pretty much everything we take for granted now. The mouse and windows, icons and pop-up menus, bitmap displays where what you saw was what you got, point and click and drag and drop. Suddenly, operating a computer could be an aesthetic experience. Who knew? I wound up at Park myself a few years after Jobs' visit. The director, John Seely Brown, was bringing in linguists, anthropologists, psychologists, and even philosophers and artists. The idea being that no technology as intensely social as this one should be entrusted to engineers to figure out. It made for a lively lunchroom, and we got to use these workstations that were more sophisticated than anything Apple would be selling for the next 15 years. But in those days, the Xerox Corporation was a complacent office equipment company that had no idea how to get most of its researchers' insights out the door. It was left to Apple to make a first installment of that vision accessible to a wide public. With just 128K of memory, the first Macintosh landed with a modest thump, not the crash of a hammer. But the echo is still audible. The second installment of that vision would have to wait until Jobs returned to Apple in the late 90s. In the meantime, the Internet had come of age, chewing up a succession of prefixes along the way. First there was cyber, which conjured up the opening sequence of Star Trek, a vast universe on the other side of the screen that we could cruise from our own private holodecks. Then came E. The image here looked less like Star Trek than Mallrats, with virtual arcades lined with virtual businesses purveying virtual wares. But after a while, the boundaries between online and offline got blurry. Where do the real banks and newspapers leave off and their e-clones begin? Then finally, there was I. The prefix had actually been in circulation for several years before Apple adopted it for those gumdrop-colored iMacs that Jobs introduced in 1999. It was originally meant to stand for Internet. But the meaning of a product name isn't something you fix in advance. It has to accumulate bit by bit like dust bunnies. And by the time that prefix was fleshed out, Apple had transformed itself from a culty computer maker to a major religion. Or anyway, that was the impression you got from the global surge of sentiment that was evoked by Jobs' death. A lot of that feeling was rooted in the obsessive attachment that people form with their iDevices, particularly the mobile iPods, iPhones, and iPads. In a period when others saw personal technology becoming a mere commodity, Jobs showed how to make high-tech appliances that were as easy to fetishize as a Rolex watch. That obviously owed a lot to Apple's genius for design, from the interface and hardware down to those nested white boxes. But the iDevices are more than just elegant and easy to use. They also invite fondling, even when they're hidden away in your pocket. In a way, they're less like a Swiss watch than a blankie or night-night, those transitional objects that children clutch to allay their separation anxiety. There's a bit of that in every cell phone, but the iObjects are standing in not just for absent loved ones, but for absent music collections, TV shows, restaurant reviews, driving directions, and baseball scores, not to mention those angry avians. We don't think of those things as floating out in cyberspace anymore. They're right here, literally on hand. The iDevices push the Internet out of our consciousness. Nobody's separated from anything anymore. Make that I for inseparable or immanent. When you think of the digital phenomena that have changed the face of daily life over the last 15 years or so, the breakthroughs are less technological than social. There are things like the iTunes Store and the App Store, blogs and Twitter, Craigslist and Wikipedia, social networks and internet dating. Or just think of the way cheap cell phones are shaping popular political movements or helping African fishermen find out which port is paying the most for their catch. This isn't just about hardware and software anymore. It isn't just about computer science anymore either. That isn't where you go to find out how technology changes people's lives or where it fails them, or how to make it less intrusive and more humane. Those are the questions people are taking up at the schools of information that have sprung up at research universities like UCLA, Toronto, and Washington. As it happens, they're called iSchools. It's a different I, but it too stands in for a connection between technology and the social world. I wound up at the one at Berkeley, surrounded by another mix of anthropologists, historians, and legal scholars, with techies and humanists to fill out the ends of the lunch table. But nowadays, it isn't odd to find technology and liberal arts intersecting on the campuses of Google and Microsoft, either. Jobs knew better than anyone that it's a bit trickier to make the final leap to artistry. But we're getting closer to his vision. As Victor Hugo might have put it, nothing is as powerful as an eye whose time has come.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.